Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me. It's been a great conference. I'm looking forward to being here the next 2 weeks. I'm going to be talking about the SPT cluster catalog and cosmological results. This is a work on behalf of a big team, a collaboration of about 70 people right now. So a lot of people's work went into this. Okay, so this is a picture of the South Pole Telescope located at the South Pole. It's a 10-millimeter wavelength telescope designed to do a large area cluster survey looking for the distortion that the clusters cause in the CMB. So it's at the heart of the instrument is a 1,000-bolometer background limited detector array with three frequencies in three frequencies at 100, 150, 220 gigahertz. Just to remind you, this is at the kind of peak and the decrement of the SC effect, and there's a channel at the 220 gigahertz null of the thermal spectrum. The beams are at about 1.5 to 1 arc minutes, which is important because it's well matched to high redshift clusters. So we really want to be able to we're designed to kind of basically be a flux survey that just can barely resolve high redshift clusters. The SPT deployed in January 2007. This is a picture of the original deployment team at the South Pole. It's a collaboration of about a dozen institutions right now and growing. And since our original deployment, 4 years later now, we're about, like I said, about 70 people spanning a range of interests in terms of the original detector builders, people developing new technologies for next-generation cameras, millimeter wavelength, optical, and X-ray and infrared astronomers. So this is not all the team is pictured even, but this is a large collaboration. So we're observing from the South Pole. So that means declination equals elevation when you're observing. This is an IRAS dust map for what we can observe from the South Pole. Basically, there's about a 4,000 square degree patch of relatively clean sky away from the galaxy that we want to look at. And we want to basically also stay below or at lower declination than -30 dec because we don't want to observe too low in the atmosphere. And so we've selected about a 2,500 square degree patch here that's broken up into these 19 boxes to do the full SPT survey, which this is our last observing season. So by November 2011, we should be finished. So far, through the end of last year, we've so far observed 1,500 square degrees to our full depth. In addition, we wanted to really identify kind of the most massive, most significant objects in our full field. So we did an additional 1,000 square degrees, so the last of the 2,500 square degrees to a shallow depth to do that. And I'll talk more about this later, but last month we released, or in January, released a catalog of the 26 most significant objects from these fields. And these numbers probably don't mean much to you, but these are our depths at the three frequencies. But the thing I wanted to emphasize is that all of our SC mapping speed is really at 100 to 150 gigahertz. You gain a little more than these numbers represent at 100 because SC is brighter in CMB decrement units. So basically, one-third of our mapping speed is at 100 gigahertz, two-thirds is at 150, and the 220 gigahertz is really not contributing at all to cluster finding. This is a picture of one of the SPT observing fields. This is 200 square degrees observed by WMAP. You can see the large-scale emission in the map. This is all primary CMB anisotropy density fluctuations, surface of last scattering. So this is the same field now observed with SPT. And there's a slight difference in the spatial filtering, but it's pretty similar. And what you can see is when you get the SPT angular resolution, you start seeing these bright point sources pop out, which weren't there before. And then in certain spots, you can even start identifying clusters, right? But it's a similar problem to what Planck and ACT are dealing with, is we really want to identify these things in this background of CMB fluctuations on their microwave millimeter wavelength emission on the sky. And so the way we do this is the same as Planck and ACT, is we make a multi-frequency matched spatial filter, which is basically using our knowledge of the noise and astrophysical signals on the sky, the spatial frequency of that noise, and then the signal that we're looking for, which are cluster-sized, few arc minute-sized objects, spatially filter the maps to deweight those contaminated spatial frequencies and upweight the frequencies where we think clusters are supposed to be at. And in addition, we know the spectrum of the SC effect really well, so we can use that to combine the three measurements and then get an overall significance of the detection. So when we observe these clusters, we don't know what redshift they're at. We only can just do this matched spatial multi-frequency spatial filter, get the signal noise detection, and then to do cosmology, we obviously want to get a redshift for all these objects. The optical follow-up's been a pretty involved and challenging endeavor because it's really large. We want to follow up hundreds of candidates, and since the SC signal is surface brightness independent, there's a lot of high redshift candidates. So sometimes when we go deep on something, we don't see it in the optical. We really want to make sure that it's not there, so we need to do something else. So we've tried to be efficient as possible by having this several-stage optical follow-up campaign. And there's a large team of people contributing to this. Both Ryan Foley and Mark Broadwin are in the audience, so please ask them more questions as well. But first, we do a digital sky survey vetting, just try to identify low redshift objects. They appear in DSS. We do observe them on SWOPE, which is a 0.9-meter telescope at Chile. They're not there. We observe them with either the Blanco telescope, which has done most of the work, or Magellan. And then for all those objects that we think are at redshift 0.6 and above, we're also proposing to observe them with the Spitzer Space Telescope. And that's really our last line of defense sanity check to know if it's a high redshift object or if it's a false detection. And Mark's been the PI of all those proposals, Mark Broadwin. So this is a catalog of the SBT cluster candidates by observing season on the left here, and then at our 95% and our 80% purity levels. All right, so one thing that we've really made an effort to do in SBT is continually improve the SBT focal plane sensitivity and observing efficiency. And you can really see that in this table, where if you look at the 2008 catalog was what we used for Vanderlyn et al., 2010. It had 22 candidates above 5 sigma. 2009 went up to 98, and then 2010 set 172. And so relative to 2008, the Vanderlyn et al. Results, we basically are 8 times more efficient at finding clusters. This will be our last observing season for the SBT-SC survey. So if you just kind of use these numbers and project, you know, how much we should see about 172 next year or this year, and the 95% purity, we should get about 440 clusters at 5 sigma and 590 at 4.5 sigma. All right, so we can use these optical measurements to measure the redshifts and predict their mass. So this is a plot of the number of clusters versus redshifts, mass versus redshifts. So the ones that we have measured redshifts for are about 200 in total, but we've optically confirmed about 300. These are a combination of photometric and spectroscopic redshifts. There's a fairly broad and high redshift distribution. Median redshift's about 0.55. And then there's a fairly broad long tail, too. So about 20 to 25% of our clusters are at above redshift 0.8. And these optical measurements also confirm that we know our purity pretty well. But at this at this signal noise of 5 level, we have about a 95% purity, like we predicted from simulations. And if you now then use this SC significance and redshift, you can also predict the mass of the cluster that we expect. And so this is now comparing the mass distribution of the Planck ESC sample in red, SBT in blue, and then the rosette 400 square degree in green. And so basically what you see is that at low redshifts, SBT is a pretty poor job of actually finding clusters because we're very CMB confused, and we don't have the spectral range and sensitivity to really spectrally remove the CMB, whereas Planck does really well, and they have the whole sky in addition. So they have a lot. They do really well at lower redshifts. At a certain point, once around redshift 0.2 or so, our dominant noise in the maps is intrinsic noise at those spatial frequencies in the measurement, detector noise, atmospheric noise, which will integrate down if we observe more. But so around 0.2 or so, we start becoming noise dominated, just this intrinsic atmospheric noise. And you see this remarkable property in the mass threshold of the SBT survey. So we know the SC surface brightness is redshift independent. In addition, a cluster of a given mass at higher redshift will be hotter. And this is basically what's causing what we expected, this nearly redshift independent mass selection, which is falling with redshift. And if you compare it to the rosette 400 square degree survey, just for reference, you know, these selection thresholds are crossing over around 0.5 or so. And this mass threshold is somewhere around 3 times 10 to the 14, although our mass calibration is still evolving, which we'll go into more in the talk. So this is a picture of 4 representative clusters. These are all high signal noise objects. These are all about 20 sigma. SBT detections, going from low redshift, medium redshifts, and then high redshifts. And then the thing I really only want to point out is, one, you know, as we get to higher redshifts, angular diameter distance is fairly flat, so we're basically barely resolving these objects in the SZ. But then also, for the optical measurements, you really see in these maps on the bottom here, the red here is the colors are the Spitzer measurements. And you can really see these clusters really pop out for Spitzer. And so this is why it's a really effective tool for us to really identify these high redshift clusters. And so the thing that SBT is really good at, of course, is since we have this unique nearly redshift independent mass selection, we're really efficient at finding these massive high redshift objects. And the most spectacular example of that so far, which I'm only going to briefly touch upon because Ryan Foley is going to talk about it tomorrow, is this cluster SBT-2106-5844. So it's a redshift 1.1 cluster. We have X-ray, SC, and IR and optical observations of it, including early velocity dispersion measurements. But the X-ray and SC measurements both indicate a mass of about 10 to the 15 solar masses. This X-ray observation indicates a luminosity of 10 to the 45 ergs. And just for reference, this is as luminous as the Bullitt cluster, but at redshift 1.1. And it was such a high redshift object, we actually had a very hard time measuring the redshifts optically. And there was a several-month ordeal, which I think Ryan's going to go into. But the first redshift measurement confirmation of this cluster was from the X-ray spectrum. And it's also relevant because of all the talk of the WARPS clusters that both Piero and Joanna Santos talked about. And we also see for this cluster a slight decrease in temperature towards its core and a fairly high metallicity, although this is only 1,500 counts in a 25 kilosecond observation. So, you know, we hope to get more time on that over time. All right, so what we really want to do, though, is use this cluster catalog to constrain cosmology, particularly a dark energy equation of state. So the first SBT cosmological result was in Vanderlin et al. 2010, which came out last year. This is a plot from that. This is the measurement, our measurement of the cluster abundance, DNDZ, versus redshift. Black points here are the SBT data points. And so what you can see, first off, is that the SBT cluster abundance is consistent with what you we expect from WMAP. These are 100 random WMAP chains. And then in addition, there's a slight, it was able to slightly improve the cosmological. There's obviously some constraining power for cosmological parameters because their error bars are much lower than that spread of those points. And just to give you a rough idea of how we constrain our cosmology, we kind of do it in a time-forward sense where we start with a given cosmology and then use that to predict what we should measure and then compare that to what we do measure. And just in slightly more detail, so it's a cosmological MCMC where we start off with a cosmology, use a Tinker mass function to predict a you know, number distribution, mass versus redshift, probability distribution. Convolve that with an assumed mass SC scaling relation, project that into our observable SC observable, which is the significance redshift space, apply our threshold cuts, and then use that to compare to our number measured counts to define a likelihood. So one issue that's also been brought up a lot in this conference is very critical to try to connect our observables to mass. And you know, in principle, one of the things that is very appealing about the SC is that it's such a clean observable. And we expect the scatter with mass to be very low, on order of 7%. However, when we're dealing with low significance detections, in particular, we have a very hard time constraining jointly the amplitude and the size. And so we can't really measure YSC very well. However, from simulations that Laurie Shaw led at McGill, the signal of noise in the spatially filtered map is a relatively good mass proxy. So if you just, from these simulations, if you measure the scatter and log mass for a given signal noise, it's about 16% scatter. All right, but now, and we're kind of trapped with these simulations in a certain sense until we get more observations because we have this fairly non-physical metric of SBT signal to noise. But regardless, you know, we can compare these simulations to measured X-ray scaling relations to calibrate them, and then we can use conservative priors on the calibration of those simulations, and that's what we've done. We assume about a 25%, what's the equivalent to 25% uncertainty on our overall mass calibration. All right, so this is the first constraints on W, dark energy equation state, versus sigma 8. On the left, just SBT plus WMAP on the right, plus supernova and BAO. So one interesting result from Manuel et al. Was even though we only had 21 clusters, our cosmological constraints were entirely limited by this assumed uncertainty in our mass calibration of 25%. And so we're not going to do much better improving these constraints until we get more until we improve our mass calibration. And you can see, though, that there was some improvement in cosmological parameters versus WMAP alone. But still, we knew mass calibration was going to be critical to our cosmology. So we've also been pursuing this very broad multi-wavelength mass calibration where we've tried to measure clusters in multi-wavelengths, X-ray observations with Chandra and XNM, weak lensing from the ground with Magellan at low redshifts. There's two proposals for Hubble, one pending, one approved, for high redshifts. And then also there's a three-year survey program on Gemini to get velocity dispersions, and then also another program on VLT that we've been pursuing. So the first thing that was a natural avenue for us was to use X-ray mass calibrations. And as we've heard today, they're very well-calibrated X-ray scaling relations, which have had a lot of cross-checks. In particular, the YXM relation has been calibrated by several authors, and it's known to have very low scatter. And as Alexei has brought up earlier, and if you read the literature, the uncertainty, the agreement between the X-ray hydrostatic mass calibration for this relation and the weak lensing mass estimates are very good in the literature on this sort of 7 to 10% level. So there's a lot of observations out there that would indicate that this is a very good calibration. But regardless, if we get our calibration down to the 10% level, that's much better than we're doing now. So what we're going to try to do is use these X-ray calibrated scaling relations to help our mass calibration. And then one final caveat is all these relations have really only been calibrated at low redshifts, sort of redshifts below 0.3. So we have a very high redshift sample. So in the future, we really need to extend this to higher redshifts as well. So this is a redshift distribution of, so what we did was we picked the 16 highest significance candidates from Vandel et al. And observed them with Chandra and XMM. This is the redshift distribution of those candidates at a very high median redshift, 0.74. And it really spanned uniformly our entire redshift range. And we were just trying to get the minimum amount of photons we needed to get a good YX measurement. And so we were aimed for 1,500 photons per cluster, which would give you about a 20% constraint on YX, and using a standard scale relation gets you down to about 12% uncertainty on M. And then if you believe other published results, it should give you about a 10% or better error on the mass. And these results were described in Anderson et al. So this is a gallery of those observations. Color is X-ray, contours are SC. And we're going from low redshifts on the top to high redshift on the bottom. So what we want to do now is use these observations, calculate YX. And I think another thing I just wanted to highlight quickly is that, I think I've been a little too dismissive of this in the past, but, it's going to be very, as we've heard a lot today, using these SC-selected, cleanly selected samples are really going to help us learn about cluster formation, also cool cores. And Carl is writing a paper just to describe the cooling core fraction of the SC-selected sample. And in particular, you can see there are actually a few of these objects which are pretty compact. This is a redshift 1 cool core here by standard definitions. This is a very extremely tight cool core. So I think, long term, you can, as we build numbers especially, you can expect more results about that. So what we first wanted to do is just check that what we were measuring in the SC matched what we were measuring expected in the X-ray. And so you can see that that's roughly true. This is the X-ray YX mass versus the SC signal, where we've used now the measured gas profile from the X-rays to spatially filter the SC maps to get a YSC value. So this is a very kind of zeroth order check that we're really measuring signal consistent with the X-rays. And so we did this, constructed a YSC mass relation, and we get a consistent slope and normalization with the self-similar and other X-ray predicted values. And this is really saying is that the YSC, YX measurements between the two experiments agree with what you'd get with the expected temperature and density profiles for clusters. Anyway, so this gave us confidence to proceed and use this these X-ray measurements to calibrate our signal-noise mass relation. This is still work underway, but we're developing a full cosmological MCMC that jointly fits for cosmology, scaling relations, YXM, and signal-noise M all at the same time. And we can use these priors from other calibrated X-ray scaling relations in this analysis. It's basically reducing our mass uncertainty about 10%. And you can see this is going to be roughly, you know, improving our sigma-8 constraints by a factor of 50% or 2 or so, and W by about 30%. Long term, you know, what we really want to do is we know we have about a 440 cluster sample, and we need to really get our mass calibration, understand our mass calibration to maximize our cosmological constraints from this. And so, you know, if kind of our goal that we're working towards is something where we could get something like a 5% mean and a 10% evolution to the mass calibration between redshift 0 and 1. So in principle, if we're able to do that, you get very, you know, this is showing the constraints now. If you combine the cluster constraints with a sample of ROSAT, the 100 brightest X-ray selective sample, X-ray brightest clusters from ROSAT, kind of analogous to in the Vauquelin et al. Analysis for the low redshift sample. If you use that to, in combination with SBT measurements, constrained sigma 8 and dark energy equation state versus dark energy, you get these approximately these constraints on sigma 8 and W. So you get a W to about 5%, as you'd expect. And then if you were able to get X-ray measurements as well for a sufficient number of these clusters, then you can start playing the game of constrain the angular diameter distance relation, which will be an interesting, you know, systematic check that is consistent with other Hubble constant supernova results. But you know, it's entirely dependent on different systematics. So it also help us know, give us confidence to know that we understand clusters really well. In addition, So basically, at the floor that we're expecting is about a 3%. You know, given these mass uncertainties, we expect a floor of about 3% on our constraints on W. So, in addition, a result that we had come out earlier this year in January was in Williamson et al. And so, the unique thing about SBT is that we do have this very clean, uniform, nearly redshift independent selection over a very large area of sky. So, it's a very good way to find the most massive clusters independent of redshift. And so this is a plot now of the 26 most significant clusters in the SBT 2500 square degree survey plotted versus redshift, where we've assumed something consistent with this 25% mass calibration uncertainty from Vanderlin et al. And over plot on top of this, we use the fitting function that was given in Mortensen, Hugh, and Herder 2010. Where, you know, this is a very relevant, this paper's come up before, but it's basically a curve where if a single cluster lied above this line for a given survey area, then it's less than 5% likely in 95% of allowed lambda CDM parameter space for the best cosmological constraints, WMAP7 plus BAO plus supernova plus H0. So these are any cluster that lied above this line would be a pink elephant for lambda CDM. And as you can see, there are about five clusters that one sigma error bars are riding up on this line, but everything's one sigma away. So if our mass calibration is correct, or one sigma high, it would be basically all these clusters would be riding on this line. But with the mass calibration is what it is, we're entirely consistent with lambda CDM. Even for 2106, where we've used an X-ray, our mass calibration, it has bumped it up slightly, but this error bar is still riding just below this consistent with lambda CDM line. In addition, we can use the entire sample to put constraints on this FNL parameter. There's also been a lot of papers coming out that have been mentioned earlier by Piero and others trying to put constraints on FNL. We find when we jointly constrain cosmology for this entire catalog, we get an FNL consistent with zero with fairly large error bars, but we don't find anything indicative of anything that's non-Gaussian perturbations. Long term, one great synergy that SBT has is that we were designed to overlap entirely with the DES cluster survey, which you've heard a lot about from Risa and Eduardo, and others are here. But This is a five-year optical survey to cover 5,000 square degrees and cover the entire SBT footprint, so it's on the southern sky. So it should detect something like an order of 100,000 clusters at redshift 1. And I have multiple dark energy probes, but in particular, we're very excited about the joint SBT-DES cluster survey, because it really is a great marriage of two surveys that have very complementary systematics. I mean, the DES is providing high numbers of clusters, weak lensing, stacked weak lensing mass calibration, analogous to what they did for MaxBCG, whereas SBT is providing a low scatter mass observable, would help calibrate the DES scatter relation more. And this synergy between the two surveys improves the DES figure of merit by about a factor of three. And Heidi, Eduardo, and Risa had a paper about that 2 years ago. What's next on the horizon for SBT is at the end of this year, starting observing next year, February 2012, SBT Pole will start, which is a survey which, again, about 1,000 pixel bolometer array, 100-150 gigahertz, and it's designed to do CMB polarization measurements, but at the same time, we're measuring temperature measurements as well, intensity. So what it will turn out to be is about a 600 square degree survey, which will be a factor of about 6 and 4 times deeper than the SBT survey at these frequencies. So what we're going to be is a smaller area, much deeper, which will give us more clusters and also allow us to go out to larger, higher redshift. And that's going to deploy at the end of this year. So in summary, there's a lot of exciting results now coming out of SC cluster surveys. We're now kind of for the first time discovering large numbers of SC selected clusters, as you've seen from SBT, Planck, ACTS also. And we're now starting to put some interesting constraints on cosmology through both Lambda CDM and the either existence or non-existence of massive clusters. The first W constraints are also coming out. And I think also something that I haven't stressed that much is that all these multi-wavelength measurements to calibrate our masses are also going to be very interesting to learn about massive cluster formation and evolution from this very cleanly selected sample going out to high redshifts. And in the future, the DES-SBT cluster survey is also going to be providing exciting results to kind of further these basic results. All right, thank you.
So a couple questions for Tim.
Your filtering attenuates stuff right outside of the cluster. So are you going to go back and reprocess and look for things in the outskirts?
We correct for the spatial filtering when we analyze the data. So we do lose signal at larger scales, but we're effectively just downweighting it, and we calculate the transfer function, the effect that has on the cluster, and correct for it. So I mean, in principle, some of that is just we'll always lose because it's just CMB confusion as you get to a large enough scale. And you could learn more about cluster outskirts for individual clusters just by stacking many clusters, and the CMB will divide down really easily, or will divide down, but the real signal from the clusters will not. But you'd have to be able to know how to stack the clusters in terms of R500 properly if you want to do that.
Any other questions before we move on to the next talk?
Hey, Brent, what's the spatial filter you're using actually? What's this? The template that you're using?
It's similar to Sayers et al. Bolocam. It's a spatial mode filter where we, on every time step in an observation, we remove the average signal from the detector wedge. So we have 6 detector wedges, and we just remove the mean signal across the whole wedge.
I'm thinking on the scale of clusters. What's the template for the clusters that you use?
The match filter. Right now we're using just beta models, actually, spaced between quarter arc minute and 3 arc minutes. And we define the clusters in terms of the maximum signal noise given those spatial templates. Basically, what we found, especially once you're getting down to low signal noise objects, we don't find clusters any more efficiently by using different spatial templates. You can use just a Gaussian if you wanted to and find clusters as efficiently. And so we've kind of taken the approach of we're going to try to, we use that spatial filter to define signal noise and then calibrate that signal noise versus mass, and that we don't see any clear improvements from using an Ernaux filter or anything else. Well, I mean, I mean, for the low signal noise objects, it's hard, right? And so even for our targeted cluster sample, where we purposely look at really bright clusters, so far we see profiles that are consistent with a beta model or our no profile, and we can't really tell the difference, or it doesn't make a difference to our integrated measurements.
Anyone else?
No.
You. We'll take one more and then punt to the main discussion.
Brad, have you, apologies if I missed it coming through, have you yet been able to measure, to compare with simulations, the scatter between your raw detect signal mm-hmm. and mass for your systems?
No, we haven't. That's a good question. I mean, I think, it's hard because since it is a low scatter, we expect it to be a low scatter observable. We want to compare to a low scatter observable. And so really, once you're talking about sort of 16, 20% scatter, all you have is YX or MGAS, something like that. But really, we only have right now an order of 15 or 20 clusters with X-ray observations, and it's really not enough to constrain the scatter very well. I mean, in Anderson et al., using that X-ray defined spatial template, we were able to fit the YX YSC relation, and that's consistent with sort of something in the order of a 9 or 10% scatter. So, but at the same time, then we're using the X-ray measurement to define the spatial filter, so that might not be ideal either. So the signal noise mass scatter we haven't defined observationally, but in principle, with more X-ray observations, you could do that.
Okay, thanks, Brad. So the second speaker in the session is Toby Marich, who will present results from our third big SC survey of the program, the Atacama Cosmology Telescope.